Accession number 28678, Mr. Dermot Rhodes, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Rhodes?
Yeah, I was born in Sheffield in South Yorkshire in 1937 on the 5th of April.
And could you tell us a bit about your family background and childhood?
Yes, we lived in, started off living in Sheffield. My father worked for the Trustee Savings Bank in Sheffield. My mother was a housewife. I have a brother who was born 2 years after I, who funnily enough also followed me into the Navy much later on. We moved out of Sheffield during the war when an incendiary bomb dropped in our front garden and burnt the hedge. And we moved to Matlock in Derbyshire for 2 years and lived on the hillside miles from anywhere.
Now, do you remember, I mean, I know you were only a child, 4 or 5 or whatever, when the incident, but do you remember the incident at all, the bombing?
Yeah, I do. Well, I remember there was a big blitz on Sheffield one Christmas, and I remember my Christmas presents went up in smoke. I remember seeing the fires, and certainly over Sheffield. I'm not so sure I remember too much about the bomb dropping in the garden. We were in the shelter by then.
And you moved to Matlock then?
Moved to Matlock, yes.
And how long was that for?
That was for 2 years. And then we moved to Rotherham, where my father had been appointed manager of the savings bank in Sheffield Savings Bank, as it was then, in Rotherham. And there he stayed for the end of his professional career. And so I went to, first of all, to... A primary school in a village called Greaseborough, just outside Rotherham, and this was a mining village. And I remember still then the miners coming home from the night shift in their clogs and with their black faces and their snap tins. And we had a very happy life there. I had a very good start at that school.
What was so good about it?
Well, the teachers were actually quite strict but very kind. The headmaster, Mr. Causer, I remember, was a frightening-looking figure. He was small, wore sort of rimless glasses and looked quite frightening, and I never actually ever spoke to him. He spoke to the school generally, but never to me personally. And he was a sort of figurehead then. The village, our life was just like any others. We were sent to Sunday school every Sunday. We were not allowed to play games on Sunday. We put on our best and we went for walks with our parents, but there was no frivolity on a Sunday. It was a typical sort of Yorkshire, a very strong non-conformist part of the world where the combined church parades on May Day or Easter, any other sort of major functions like that, consisted of about 3 or 4 non-conformist chapels in the village, plus the parish church, plus anybody else who wanted to join in. So it was quite a conventional, I suppose at the time, traditional South Yorkshire upbringing.
Now, how did your education progress after the village school?
Well, after the village school, I went to the junior school of the grammar school in Rotherham then when I was 7. And funnily enough, then, I always had a very good singing voice, and I passed the audition to get into Rotherham Parish Church Choir then as a choir boy. And choral singing remained a passion throughout my life until this very day, and I still do a lot. But that's where it started then, at the age of 7. And I went to the grammar school, junior school, then took the 11 plus and passed into the grammar school, senior school proper. And there my great sort of outside school activities were sport and music.
Now, I'll come back to that. How did you do at the school? I mean, and what kind of school? Was it a traditional old Yorkshire grammar school?
It was a traditional grammar school. I mean, looking at it now, it it was fairly basic. It was just after the war. And I remember a number of the teachers coming back still wearing uniform. And the few that were there, some of them were in the Home Guard or the Army Cadet Force and used to appear in uniform once a week. And so the facilities were fairly basic. The tennis courts hadn't been used throughout the war. We were, funnily enough, a hockey school in the winter, hockey and soccer, and then, of course, cricket in the summer.
And how did you do at school? What were your subjects?
Well, I was lucky. I was one of those guys who always seemed to be able to pass exams, but I'm a terrible sort of burning the midnight oil the night before exams. And unfortunately, I never got out of this habit because I kept passing exams right throughout the whole of my life, really. And so I was in the upper stream of the grammar school stream, and normally in the top three in the upper stream. I loved reading. I read from a very early age, encouraged by my father. Funnily enough, one of the early books that he got me hooked on was Hornblower, which may have coloured my selection of a career later on. I enjoy my sport. Played a lot of hockey there, a little football.
Which subjects did you go for? I mean,
In those days, you didn't get any choice about what subjects you do. And this was the demise of the old school certificate and just the very, very early days of what was the GCE O-levels in those days. And I had passed, I think, or qualified to take Latin I did, French, history, geography, English literature, maths, and I think general science. We didn't split then into physics, chemistry and biology, and then odds and sods like woodwork. But there were none of the esoteric subjects that kids can take today. And so that was my school life. I got into swimming, actually. My father became treasurer, then president of the local amateur swimming club, and I got very much involved with that. And so it was 2 evenings a week choir practice and 2 evenings a week swimming club, which just about filled the week. And then, of course, church services on the Sunday singing.
Now, what about, tell us a bit more about your sporting activities, because you mentioned how important they were off tape. Swimming was the main thing, was it?
Swimming was the main thing, and of course, like any other sport, but particularly I find swimming training was the actual element. And I used to do it seriously, used to enter local swimming galas and racing, and I played water polo from quite an early age then, and the club I was in were members of the Wakefield and District Water Polo League, and so we used to climb into a tobacco-filled, rickety old coach of an evening and go off into the darkness into Pontefract and Featherstone and other South Yorkshire delightful places to go and see Doncaster and Barnsley to play water polo, play in the league then. And we always, those evenings where you go and play a water polo match, well, water polo match doesn't actually last very long, so we had a little sort of swimming gala as well attached to it, a few races that you take part in. So it was an evening out. And so I did that together with me. I played a lot of hockey at school. I played occasionally once or twice for the first 11, but mainly for the second. Cricket when I could. I did play once or twice for the local Rotherham Town, one of their youth teams. But I found that I just didn't have time to do everything I wanted to do. So I had to give that up. And only play occasionally at school. And
Were you in the combined cadet force?
No, I wasn't. Not at all. I'd thought about joining the Scouts. I'd thought about joining the Sea Cadets. But that was the same. Their night was the same night as choir practice, and I was just into the singing and church music so much that I stuck with what I'd started with.
Now, when did you develop your interest, do you think, in the Navy, or before you could?
Well, it must have been, I suppose, when I was about 13 or 14. There were three of us very chums together. And one of my great friends went off to HMS Conway, which was the Merchant Navy training ship in North Wales, with the view then of going into the Merchant Navy. I'd before that wanted to go into medicine, be a doctor. It became increasingly obvious that my science was a bit weak. And so I sort of slightly made in mind, I thought I'd like to be a doctor in the Navy. And as time went on, and my strength in my classical subjects improved, and I couldn't fathom physics or chemistry or anything. I dropped the doctor bit and just stuck to the Navy bit.
Now, why the Navy? What attracted you to the Navy, or was it just warm love?
I think that was a part of it, but I think actually the thought of doing a 9-to-5 job in South Yorkshire did not appeal to me. I decided to join the Navy, having decided that doctoring was probably not my forte at all. And so I made inquiries at school about taking the Dartmouth entrance exam, and I was advised that it was really a waste of time, as the Navy didn't accept Dartmouth people from South Yorkshire grammar schools. And in that time, actually, the Dartmouth entrance exam, they just changed from the 13 entry as a result of Labour, I must say, socialist government pressure. They'd altered the age of entry to 16. And so it was under the 16 entry umbrella that I applied. But certainly the staff, I remember my Latin master in particular, I was quite good at Latin, saying, you haven't a hope. Well, I did. I applied, and I went for an interview. I worked out I had two shots to get in. If I failed the first time, I had another shot to get in. And then I could have had a third when I was 18, because they had an 18 entry as well. But I managed to get in on the 16 entry. And I shall never forget the interview. Having taken the written exam, if you pass the written exam, you were then called forward to interview. And you had to go down to Dartmouth part of it was in London, part in Dartmouth for 3 days, and do mainly aptitude tests, stand up 1-minute lectures on the subject that they gave you, take part in discussions. And I, to this day, remain convinced that I thought I got into the Navy on the strength of two aspects of it. First of all, that during one of the practical exercises involving getting a bucket of water over a make-believe cannon, a chasm, I spilt the whole bucket of water over the Admiral's dog, which was a particularly offensive little Pekingese. I'm not sure that the Admiral was very impressed, but the others fell about laughing. And finally, the second one was some chap, as I left, one of the officers on the board said, you any relation to Wilfred Rhodes? And I was very tempted. But I said, well, unfortunately not, but I wish I could play cricket only a fraction of as well as he could. So they all smiled and thought that was a good thing. And so I got into Dartmouth.
And what year was that, or what month even?
That was, I actually joined Dartmouth at the end of April 1953. 16 entry, 2 years at Dartmouth. And I remember the uniform,
you'd passed a joint. Now, what was it, the Dartmouth then, it's the Royal Naval College, is it?
Britannia Royal Naval College, Dartmouth.
And what was your, I mean, you were still quite a young lad, and people were younger then.
I was barely 16. I'd just taken my mock O-levels. I never actually took any O-levels at all.
What was your reception like when you arrived? Because we're quite interested in how people are treated when they you arrive as a civilian, and you know.
Well, your uniform arrived about 2 days before you left home, so you put it on. You were always everybody was measured for uniforms during the interview phase. Mr. Gieve came down from it wasn't so, it was just Gieves then. And those who were successful then had their uniforms made up, and the travelling uniform was sent to you to arrive about 2 days before you left home. So you didn't have much chance to A, learn how to put it together, and B, how to wear it, but you had to turn up wearing uniform. So you arrived there, and of course...
What was the uniform?
Well, there it was exactly the same as today. It was a full, what we call number 5, double-breasted, 4 brass buttons down the front. Instead of stripes on the sleeve, you had braids on the collars, twists of braid on the collars. Normal officer's cap and cap badge for lieutenant commanders and below. Black shoes, obviously. And, first time I'd ever worn one in my life, a stiff white collar and a stiff white shirt. So I had to get working round two studs, collar studs, one at the back, one at the front. I could tie a tie, obviously. But that's where grandfathers came in, very useful, because they were used to managing the stiff collars in those days. And so off we went on the train to Dartmouth.
Now, what happened when you got there?
Met one or two people on the way down, and when we arrived at the station, we all bundled into lorries with our bags and trundled up to the college, where we were divided into houses, and it was all extremely well organised. It's fairly Spartan living. I had never been away from home before at all, and I was surrounded by public school boys. But interestingly, quite a significant coterie of grammar school boys, including more Yorkshire grammar school, mainly from Leeds and places like that. There are about half a dozen of us, I suppose. But not many of us had never been away from home before, and so it was all slightly bewildering. But we were shown into these huge dormitories, which contained about 60 people. You had an iron bedstead, a sea chest to keep all your clothes in, and all your kit, which they'd already labelled with your name, was in there. You then had to lay it out as per the instructions, which is the way it was had to be every night for the next 2 years, and inspected.
Now, what kit did you have, and how were you meant to lay it out?
Well, gosh. They always said everything. They did. You were not allowed to wear any civilian clothes there at all, unless they were of their approved design and part of the kit. And so, as well as your straight, say your best naval uniform, which was your superfine jacket, trousers, and you know your brass buttons and everything else, and your stiff collars, you wore that once a day in the evenings. But during the day, you wore a working rig. It's like a jersey and a blue sailor shirt and a pair of blue serge trousers. And a pair of shoes and a normal cap. All your sports gear, there were rugby shirts, multi-purpose, a blue one and a white one, shorts, football boots, stockings, socks, underpants, toilet gear. They provided you with toothbrush, a toilet bag, an oil, a yellow oilskin job, I remember to this day. A housewife, needle, cotton thread, and a pair of scissors, comb, a brush, a hairbrush, and a clothes brush, pajamas, all nightwear. Didn't have dressing gowns, they were only for the very senior cadet captains. I think that's about all. I mean, everything. You did not need anything from home. Oh, you give a pair of grey flannel trousers, some naval tropical shirts, which were short sleeve white ones with a soft collar, a naval tie, a trilby hat, a brown or dark green, I remember, for going ashore. And a blazer, a sort of serge blazer, rather, I won't say they were tailored in Savile Row, but these you wore for sporting gear and also for the very rare occasions when you were let out of the place. So that was your kit.
Now, how were you meant to lay it out? I mean,
it was all contained in a big sea chest, which was about 3 feet wide, and about 4.5 feet, 4.5 feet high, and in it had shelves and drawers and a little lockable drawer for your what little cash you had, and there was a set way of folding your stuff and putting it into the various shelves in various positions. And at night, every night around the dormitories, you used to have night rounds where your house officer, who was normally a lieutenant in the Navy, the duty cadet captain, and maybe one of the used to come round and inspect the dormitories. Your kit, it had an open flap on the front like a desk thing had opened, and your kit that you were wearing had to be laid out on that. in a set way. You had to lie to attention in bed with the covers up to the chin.
Now, how was the place organized? So you were in houses. Was that for how the classes were organized in houses or how?
No, it was the place was the college was divided up into houses, big houses, all named after famous admirals: Grenville, Blake, Exmouth. I was in St. Vincent House, and there must have been about 120 of us in the house. The chap at the top was the house cadet captain. He was a senior term cadet. And obviously, when we arrived, he'd been there for nearly 2 years, and he was sort of by two house cadet captains, and they wore special chevrons on the sleeve to denote their seniority. They had special privileges and special duties. And then the senior term had a special sort of common room. That's the very senior term. And then the upper house or the senior house had their own common room and the junior house. So with a 2 year course there, after 1 year and three terms, you went up into the senior year. We, of course, as plebs, right down at the bottom, it was best to be seen and not heard. You were not allowed to, you just didn't call anybody senior to you by their Christian name. You call them by the surname. And to this day, I found extreme difficulty in meeting anybody who was 3 months senior to me at Dartmouth by their Christian name. I can call admirals by their Christian name or since then, and all sorts of other people I met senior, but not those who are contemporaries of Dartmouth. Do you want to know about the routine at Dartmouth? That was a bit of a shock.
Daily routine, I mean, whichever way...
Right, well, if we start with the daily routine, because that was a bit of a shock. You were up at 6 o'clock and you had to have a cold bath. And the cadet captains were watching you and actually go under the bath, under the water. There's no just flicking it over your body. You then went to prep for an hour from 6:30, 7:30.
Now prep, which is?
That's like homework, but in early in the morning. Then you went to breakfast. And then you went to...
Now might be a good idea to ask about the food. I mean, you'd never left home, mother's cooking, etc., etc. How did you find the food there, your first taste of institutional food other than school dinners, I presume?
Well, the food was very wholesome, very filling. One or two aspects of naval habits that I'd never had. I mean, being brought up in South Yorkshire, where everything was basic, roast beef and Yorkshire pudding if you were lucky, but otherwise pretty basic stuff, no exotic or erotic stuff. And it was at Dartmouth I first met curry, and I wondered what the hell it was. And it took me a long time to get used to curry. And anything else like that. We had a fearsome ex-Wren officer, Second Officer Wrens, called Miss Buller, who was responsible for the catering. She was a very large lady, carried all before her, and she would parade around the dining room at meal times, making sure that the cadets ate. There were carrots there. You had to eat raw carrots and a glass of milk, and you had to drink your milk and your carrots. And if you didn't, the wrath of Miss Buller would, and she had an eagle eye, and all the old pensioner stewards who served us would be her sort of intelligence service and would report if any cadet wasn't eating his carrots and his milk. So the food was pretty wholesome, basic. It was a hot breakfast with cereal. We didn't have fruit juice then, but it was always sort of bacon egg type of stuff, or beans, or, you know, hot sausages. First time I'd ever met tinned tomatoes as well, but they came up. Kedgeree, I'd never met kedgeree before. Suddenly found that being served for breakfast. I love kedgeree now, but that was...
Was there enough of it?
Oh yes, always.
We might as well follow the meals through just to get them out of the way in one
minute. Yeah, okay.
What about lunch or dinner, whatever you want to call it?
Well, lunch was soup and a hot meal and a pudding course, and that was it. There was bread and water. I can't really remember too much about lunch. The other thing that I found was the speed with which, and the public school boys seemed to bear magic no problem at all, but which everybody ate their meals, and we were struggling. They were down in a flash. But you didn't have very much time to start lingering over your meals, because it was in there and then you were off. And believe it or not, after lunch, we all had to go to bed for half an hour.
The evening meal, there was tea.
You came back for tea, and that was lots of basic jam and butter and bread, and a cup of tea. And then supper was another cooked meal as well, not quite as substantial as lunch. But that was with a cup of Kai, which is a famous naval cocoa, which figured largely in our lives for a few years after that. It's cocoa made from huge slabs of strange chocolate and mixed with hot water and custard and anything else that was left over from lunch or whatever. It's quite not particularly on the bridge of a freezing cold bridge.
So that's the food all day, and generally reasonable quality and enough.
I never ever felt hungry there.
Now, after breakfast, we'll go back into the...
The routine.
After breakfast,
it was studies. And therefore, you went to studies all morning. And we studied when I was there. We did history, English, English literature. And then we did maths, and we did physics and the dreaded... physics, chemistry. I was in the top set for... Oh, and I took up Spanish as well, and French. I was in the top set for the Spanish, French, history, and English literature. I was in the bottom set for maths. maths and physics and chemistry. I sort of struggled around there.
These
for
are
a couple
basically
of years.
A continuation of your education. These are educational classes in these subjects.
Yeah.
They're not tailored.
The aim was, in the space of 2 years, to get you up to university entrance standard. It was that level. You did go to university, but it was that level. And it was the equivalent of A-level these days.
So it wasn't tailored to the Navy, it was just an education.
Yes, it was, because I haven't quite finished. Interspersed with these educational subjects were naval, and you started looking at marine engineering. You started looking at navigation, basic navigation. And the history side was slanting more and more to naval history.
Well, let's pick that last, because and we'll do the other two. Naval history. Now, which part of naval history were you doing? Was it sort of the tradition of Nelson, or was it the practical lessons of the First and Second World War? Or what type of naval history was it? Or was it just naval history generally from the year dot?
It was naval history generally, but not really from the year dot. It really concentrated on the famous sea battles, at least those that we won, from the 17th and 18th and early 19th centuries, really. We did very little outside that. Having said that, in our in our joining week, we had to sit and watch In Which We Serve, you know, the usual sort of propaganda films and one or two others like that, just to get us thinking along the right sort of lines. But actual studying, it was a fairly sort of small bracket of naval history.
So it wasn't the Second and First World War?
It wasn't the Second and First World War. No, we did very little on that.
Were people like Nelson and the traditions of Nelson really brought out at the time? I mean, this is the year of the anniversary.
Yes, they were.
And, I mean, then, was it still important, or was he...
Oh, yes, he was tremendously important, but interestingly, it was brought out gradually. It wasn't suddenly whoomph, hit you straight between the eyes with it. And so we started off with some of the earlier admirals, and, you know, there's St. Vincent's and even earlier than that. And Nelson was, I mean, we all knew about Nelson anyway before, and we were all eagerly waiting. But Trafalgar came up just as one of the battles that... was used to study naval tactics in those days.